Blog Talk Radio.
Tons or whatever of salt in the back of the truck and a big ass plow that
rolling 18 hours.
Just think, if you park in the wrong spot and he's having a shitty day, your day is going real bad now.
Yeah, now the way the county runs it is they run them, they'll run them for like 2 hours until their dump's empty. Then they'll go back when they go to refill. Then another driver takes the truck and they have a break for however long that person is out on the road. So if they need to take a nap or do whatever, they have the time to do it.
Yeah, so they're still paid while they're sitting back waiting on the truck to return, right?
Yep.
Oh, okay. You see that?
And it's government, so do you know it's time and a half or double time?
Yeah, that's just crazy. I did, let's see, what was it, 96, I think, we had a pretty severe storm roll through. Now, Richmond, you know, we get snow here and there. I think we got 5-6 inches last night, all of yesterday and last night. Virginia Beach, I saw a friend of mine actually stuck a wooden ruler into the snow to show how deep there was on, like, the patio table. They had 7.5 inches of snow yesterday. But this one storm in 96 that I was stuck, at the time I was, you know, working for a landscape contractor. So we've got all the, you know, little grade boxes and bobcats and all that. Well, of course, it's real hard to do grade work when you can't find a damn grade stick under 18 inches of snow. So we're off for a week and a half. Well, I took advantage of it. I went and snatched the machinery, and I'm out clearing driveways and, you know, parking lots and whatever else I could get a hold of to make money. Dude, I made mad bank, like $2,500 in a week.
Oh, yeah.
So,
I always
good money in it.
I always said around here, like, what I want to do is buy, like, a Suzuki, like, King Quad 400cc, put a manual lift plow on it, and just run around the subdivisions, putting up flyers, hey, $20, I'll do your driveway, and just go around after work, whatever, go hit the driveway with a 48-inch blade, put it on an angle, it'll do a sidewalk, and it'd be like three passes to do a driveway.
Yeah, the only trouble with that, dude, is you're exposed to Mother Nature, and she's a cold, heartless bitch.
Yes, yes, she definitely is.
Yeah, I'd much rather be in the cab of a truck where there's this amazing invention called heat.
Heated grips. You can buy heated gear. Heated grips, heated gear, snowmobile helmet. You're good.
Man, but no, I can definitely sympathize with the folks down in Georgia. I watched the news tonight, and the roads were just a giant skating rink. We could have hosted the Winter Olympics on their highway system. So, they're like showing vehicles that are like weaving in and out. And it looks like they're weaving in and out of a parking lot. They literally were, but it was, you know, I-75. It was where people just gave up and said, "Oh, screw it," and left their car and walked to wherever.
That's right. I got a buddy that moved down to Memphis, and Tennessee, really kind of the same situation. They don't have plows. They don't have salt. You know, I mean, they're not equipped to deal with the weather like we are. So, but he grew up from birth up until, hell, he was probably 27, 28 when he moved down to Memphis. And he's got a Toyota Tacoma pickup truck, and he works at a hospital. He works in critical care, so he has emergency tag plates. And
right.
He was saying, he's like, "Man," he goes, "you know, we got like 2 inches and people abandon their cars on the side of the road." He goes, I don't understand it. He's like, I wasn't even in four-wheel drive, and I was still, you know, 65 mile an hour speed limit. He's like, I was still doing 45 and I was fine. He's like, I'm weaving in and out of traffic like it's a video game just to get to work. He goes, it's funny. He's like, I don't know if it's the same in other parts of the South. He's like, but, and I can use this term because he has a hell of a Southern drawl now. It's almost as strong as yours. But he's like, you get these damn hillbillies that, you know, they'll go in the mud and they drive like absolute batshit crazy people. He goes, but you put a little bit of snow on the road, he's like, and you see four by four pickup trucks abandoned on the side of the road. He goes, I don't get it. I'm like, yeah, well, for us, it's normal.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've had my truck, you know, in the mud to the point that, well, I didn't have an option but to abandon it. It wasn't coming out. But, you know, most of them down here just haven't figured out that mud and ice are two totally different things.
Ice is a different story.
Yeah. Now, snow, oh, I'll run like hell for the snow. But you throw down some ice, and no, there's nothing really to bite on to. So odds are good you're going to have a bad day. Things go boom, and then you're trying to figure out how to sell the insurance company. Yeah.
Yeah, so I don't care if you're an 18-wheeler or not, you know, or a Toyota Prius. You still have the same stopping power on ice, which is none.
Exactly. Now, I will tell you a way to figure that out, though, and you don't hardly see them anymore in, well, I haven't. You might, but you know, two totally different driving environments. But studded snow tires.
They're illegal.
Because we don't get them out.
They're illegal on the roads here.
Yeah. I don't know if they're illegal here or not, but, you know.
Who the hell would buy them?
I remember as a kid.
I mean,
that was the spare that we, you know, Dad always kept a spare set of winter tires, and they were studded snow tires.
Well, I will tell you one thing. With all this, you know, crap that we've been getting and the abundance of snow plows that we have here, I'm definitely glad that I have my Jeep with the balloon tires on it, putting it in four-wheel drive compared to my Audi that was all-wheel drive, because I probably would have gone through at least 20 to 25 rims with the potholes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Now, they use a lot less salt down here than they do up there, and our roads look like they are, you know, pre-existing minefields. I've had to replace two wheels on wife's car because of the potholes. And a lot of the people that I know drive the little ricers with the like little low-profile wheels and all, they're replacing wheels. I'm like, you know, I'd rather go big. I don't have to worry about them nearly as much.
Yeah, my 33-inch Mickey Thompsons do pretty good over most terrain. Oh, you remember my speaking of ice, you remember my ice story pulling into work? What was that, a year ago, 2 years ago?
Yeah, when you tried to occupy space with another vehicle simultaneously.
And a for-sale vehicle in the parking lot of work, Mercedes E-Class, that I turned the wheel and the Jeep didn't do anything except go straight into the front of the Mercedes.
No, it did something else. It laughed hysterically. While you screamed hysterically, I'm sure.
The only thing that happened to my Jeep was a couple scrapes on the metal bumpers, and one of the end caps of the metal bumper was in the front of the Mercedes. Once I ripped my Jeep out of the front of the Mercedes. And it was grill parts and put the condenser into the front pillar where the hood latch is and popped the condenser so it was hissing out coolant. Yeah, no, it was a good time. The boss was happy.
Oh, I'm sure. But so now that we've done the weather report and traffic and everything else, what do you say we talk about tonight's program?
Well, tonight's program has a returning dear friend of ours that has some new, never released information about H.H. Holmes and Jack the Ripper. It is our dear friend Dane Ladwig, who I see has called in. When I made the post on Facebook, I'm not exaggerating at all, he refused to tell me what the actual information is. So that was also part of the reason why, I know a lot of the lyrics don't fit, but that's why I switched the intro song to Playing God, because that's what both Holmes and the Ripper did, is basically played God with human beings, and that was Playing God by Paramore. So I thought it kind of fit. That's my loose tie to the intro song. But yeah, I'm definitely interested to hear what the new info is, and also Dane does have some other interesting information and exciting information that I'll let him talk about and not give a spoiler alert on. So it seems like he's with us. Dane, what's going on, brother?
Hey, how you doing, Matt? Dennis, how you doing, buddy?
I'm doing good, brother, doing good. Glad to have you back with us, man.
Glad to be back. Now, before we get started on that stuff, I've got to ask you guys something. Something that is very pertinent, something that is going to take over our weekend. Broncos or Seahawks?
Plenty of beer.
Go ahead. Broncos or Seahawks?
Ooh.
Bud Light? Can I take that one? Because that's the important part for me, brother. I really don't care which team wins it. I'll just be grateful when it's all over and done with. I am interested to see, though, whether or not Mother Nature cooperates for an outside Super Bowl.
I was kind of thinking Seahawks, to be honest. And that does have weather condition a lot into it, because Seattle has a lot worse weather than what Denver has. Denver gets cold and snow, but they get cold. It snows at night, you know, a little bit during the day, but it still gets in the 60s in December. So, I don't know. Being in New York, I'm not officially calling it, but I'm leaning more towards the Seahawks.
Well, let me tell you, I love things about both the teams, you know, and I hate to say that I'm one of the neutral middle players, but honestly, if my numbers come in, that's all I care about. But I read an interesting article where John Elway said that when he hired Peyton Manning, he wanted to make sure that Manning ended his career as the best quarterback ever to have played football. Now, I want to ask you seriously, when I say who is the best quarterback ever in the NFL, does Peyton Manning come to the front of your mind?
No. He's up there on the list, but not the best.
Not the best ever.
Nah,
I'll agree. He's up there
opinion.
On the list. He's up there on the list, but he's not the best ever. I mean, so many others roll off my tongue before him.
Yeah, he's definitely. I'd put him in. Well, I mean, how far are they saying ever? Like, you know, are we talking ever, or just within a generation ever?
Well, according to John Elway, what he said to the press was the best quarterback ever to play football.
Yeah, I wouldn't even put him in the top five of best ever.
He would make the top 10 on my list, but the top,
yeah,
the best ever, no.
Yeah, I'd put him in top 10, but not top five.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just in numbers wise, he's you know, behind so many people, so like as of right now in his career, whatever his career is done, who knows at that point. But
I mean, you have to give him props. You know, even his own brother thought that after his neck surgery, he wouldn't even be returning to the NFL. You know,
yeah.
I give him credit for that. The guy has heart. He really does.
Yeah, I'll definitely give him that. But, I mean, when you compare just in the last decade or call it the last 15 years, I mean, you have somebody, you know, like a staple like Brett Favre, and then you have another one like Aaron Rodgers who's coming up just in the Packers alone, that their numbers are higher in general just in those two. I mean, you bring up quarterbacks, John Elway is going to be one of them. Brett Favre is going to be another name. I mean, hell, the whole roster of the 85 Bears. But
you know, I'll go back even further than that. Joe Namath.
Yeah.
He was a great quarterback. He's in my top five list.
Yeah. He was phenomenal. I mean, there's – let me ask you, and I – Dennis, I didn't know – yeah, this is turning into a sports show. But which is fine, actually. But the
– we'll change it in a minute.
So in – I forget where the hell I was going with that. Okay, so, we were talking about this at work. If you put the 85 Bears, who everybody know or most people know, I mean, there's people who are born in the 90s that are like, who? It's like Walter Payton, and that's pretty much who everybody knows. But if you took a lineup from the time when Joe Namath played or the 85 Bears and a lot of the famous ones in the past in the 70s and 80s and even early 90s, if you were to put them against a NFL team today as far as athlete capability, I don't think that they'd be good at all. I think the current athletic ability of – I don't think current athletic ability would stomp what all these gridiron, you know, guys went through back in back even not that long ago.
But I will say that so many new rules and regulations have been placed on the NFL that you had a lot more freedom with your players, had a lot more freedom to no other way to say it, but to cause pain and injury, and freedom to expand, you know, rack up the yardage, rack up the touchdowns 30 years ago than you do now.
can't even celebrate a touchdown anymore. It's, yeah, okay, I made it in. And,
no.
All right.
And on the same token, back then 30 years ago, they would have never thought of getting into the end zone and doing some of the things that they do now. They would have been laughed out of the stadium.
Well, that's the funny thing. We were talking about that, too. It's like, all right, if I'm out there getting the shit kicked out of me and I actually make it across that line, I want to have a little party. I don't see what that hurts.
Well, within reason.
Yeah.
Within reason.
Yeah, I don't want it to go on as long as the halftime show, but, yeah, do a little dance and we're good with it.
So, Dane, who are you calling?
I'll be honest with you. I really don't care. Honestly, I do not care. I entered into a couple of different pools. I'm hoping my numbers come in. That's all, honestly. Now, I know that I can't say that I've put any investment pools, so I won't, in case anybody's listening. But as long as my numbers come in, I really don't care.
Yeah. I guess we have a pool at work between the car side and us, and everybody gets into it, and I think the total pot's like $1,000 or something like that, but I haven't gotten in squares in like the last 3 years. I won, I think it was like $50 or $500 the first year, but I didn't take it because my boss was the one who put my name in for the squares, and I didn't give any money, so I just said, you know, buy lunch on me or whatever. I think it was only $50. I don't think it was $500.
And if the IMS is listening, it was all donated to charity.
Yes, yeah. There you go.
it was donated to the people's bellies that year. But no, I just said, I'm like, I didn't put any money in. I don't deserve any money. So I caught a lot of shit at work today for that, actually. But it is what it is.
Yeah,
I'll tell you, my two teams,
all the pools and all that, and I don't follow it enough to even make it worthwhile. Even if it was, you know, you put in $5 and we'll cover you for the, you know, other 15 or whatever on the $20 pool. I don't watch sports enough to know.
I keep up with football. Yeah, I keep up with the football, get into football pools, and I keep up with hockey. And if one of my two teams that I follow very closely, naturally, the Bears, and I'm a diehard Saints fan. If either one of those teams made it in, naturally I'd be getting in every pool I could.
For charity.
Yes. Oh, yes. For Gambling Anonymous.
Yeah. This is all charity.
Bragging rights. So
yep.
It is bragging
yep.
rights.
Right, right. Now, I'm going to ask you a question. When thinking about Jack the Ripper and Dr. Holmes, Dr. H.H. Holmes, have you ever considered about their MOs, modus operandi, and if they match or if they do not match or how they match or anything like that?
Well, that was going to be one of the things that I wanted to talk to you about because in the research that I've been able to do, just so I, you know, sound semi-literate during this interview and others that we've had and other conversations off air that we've had, Jack the Ripper was notorious for surgically precise incisions and pretty damn much disemboweling his victims. Then when his stopped and there was that single one done in New York, it was done under pretty much the same MO. Is that correct?
Well, the one in New York, and we'll get to that one later. However, that one was proven to be a copycat murder. What I want to do is right now is stick to the murders that we know, the canonical five murders that happened in Whitechapel, and what we know of Dr. Holmes that happened at his murder castle in Chicago. And then we'll introduce other things as we go along. How's that?
Well, I was actually going to call as far as the MO of all of the murders combined, in Whitechapel, the first three, in my personal opinion, the first three match Holmes' MO and also match the Ripper's MO. In Whitechapel, I'm saying. The later ones do not, and that's where I would actually kind of consider it more of a copycat. And dissecting cross of when, of timelines and all that, to where brutality was more introduced in the last two in Whitechapel of documented that were supposed Ripper cases. It just, it wasn't as clean, it wasn't as precise, it wasn't as, it wasn't as decent in a horrible terminology to use for that, but it wasn't as decent as the last two.
Now, in my book, in my book, Dr. H.H. Holmes and the Whitechapel Ripper, I've mentioned to you before that through my research, I've not only found through the timeline that Dr. Holmes was in Whitechapel during the murders, but he also has a residence in Whitechapel.
Really?
Yes, which will be in my book as well. And I'm going to show you now.
Well, Whitechapel is the Ripper Toronto area, correct?
Pardon me?
Whitechapel, is that the Toronto area?
Toronto? You're in the wrong part of the world there, buddy.
I'm completely confused then. Where was Whitechapel? I'm missing something in the story here.
London, England.
Oh, okay. Okay, yeah. Okay.
Where the hell did you get to Toronto?
There is also a correlation to Holmes in Toronto, but that goes to another part.
Yes, there is, and we can get to that too. No, actually, he's very right that Holmes did commit a murder in Toronto, which some people are unaware of. Not only will I and do I prove and show in my book that an ascension, if you will, a MO that is consistent with Holmes' killings in Chicago, but how both modus operandi actually cross each other and are nearly identical. Holmes committed his murders in Chicago behind closed doors in a murder castle. But when you actually compare the forensic evidence of the Ripper victims, there's a progression. And the Ripper was attempting to accomplish the impossible, that which what Holmes was able to carry out in the basement of the murder castle. In this program, however much longer we have, we're going to take a very close look at the Ripper's final victim, Mary Kelly. And I'm going to show you how her murder is nearly identical to the murders that Dr. H.H. Holmes had committed. What say you guys to that?
Definitely all for it.
I'm fine with it. I'm just trying to figure out how all these different locations tie together, you know, and I don't know. I mean, just the whole serial killer genre at this point fascinates me. You know, and if we have time, I've got a couple that I also want to speak of and see what your knowledge is on them that are totally separate from H.H. and Jack and, you know, all of that.
Now, as we know, there have been over between 400 and 600 books written on the Ripper, and a slew of movies made on the Ripper, and theories that have come out, numerous theories, some totally bizarre, and others that are plausible. But when you match them up with the evidence, there are just too many holes and you can't, they just don't carry any water. Now, if you take the evidence that I was able to acquire from Scotland Yard, they were kind enough to allow me a privilege to have them for my book. Actually, it kind of helps when you have a family member who set you up with somebody there, who is a very good friend of the family. And you look at those confidential crime scene reports. And you start seeing things and say, wait, let's go back a page because I noticed something with Holmes that fits this description. And this seems to be something Holmes did. And then you go back and you look and you say, now, is that coincidence or what? But then it keeps happening. It happens over and over again. Now, I'll tell you, in all the years that I've been studying the Ripper, and it's been many decades, I would take a look at a suspect. I'd match him up against her, or her up against the theory, up against the evidence, and the theory would just fall apart. Not with Holmes. With Holmes, the evidence would just turn over stone after stone after stone after stone and reveal more and more and more and more. And that was the first time in the last 40 years that that happened. That wasn't convincing enough, though. What was convincing and compelling was when I started matching up dates when Holmes was in England, when I started matching and comparing notes, what knowledge Holmes had as far as anatomy and the reason and purpose of his murders, compared with what was going on with the victims of the Ripper. And then there were correlations, many correlations. Now, even today, I had someone who was asking me, well, why was Holmes so meticulous? Because they didn't find anything, you know, he didn't leave a mess behind. Well, that's because he had people who were his lackeys who were cleaning up after him, constantly cleaning up after him. Why was Jack the Ripper so messy? Well, in essence, he was and he wasn't. There are things in my book that are going to be revealed. Jack the Ripper was not as messy as people believe he to be. The reason why people think he was messy is because of Mary Kelly's, the final victim's murder. The previous four murders, Jack the Ripper actually took the time to drape their clothing over their wounds. And in one case, the actual autopsy report reflects that the body must have been moved and placed there, or the blood had to be cleaned up because there was no trace of blood. So for Jack the Ripper to take time to cover his victims' torsos with their own garments, or the lack of blood at the one scene, indicates that the victims were being cleaned up, taken care of. And this is based not upon my opinion or conjecture or theory. This is based on the facts in the confidential crime scene reports from Scotland Yard. And these are reports that should have been made public years ago. Had they been, maybe if someone would have spent the time to invest in Holmes as a suspect, they would have tied the connection.
Well,
questions?
I don't think back then, though, they had the lines of communication to where in what happened with the Ripper cases, that word would have traveled as fast as it would with more modern communication technology.
Correct. However, Inspector Aberling, the main inspector on the Ripper cases, he had access to all the files. He had the ability to see everything I saw. But what was missing back then, they did not know about Dr. H.H. Holmes and his connection. And there's a reason for that. Although Holmes was in London, Holmes, his identity was being hidden. And yes, it was a conspiracy. And it was from very high up in the Parliament. And you'll read about it in the book. And that's as much, I'm sorry it's a teaser, but that's all I can give you as far as that goes.
Well, if, and this is the part that I don't understand, if Holmes was Jack the Ripper, why did he go from doing such horrific, sophisticated, medically eviscerations to just stuffing them in incinerators and other things like that in such a, would be considered a lazy manner to kill when he got to Chicago with the murder castle?
In Chicago at the murder castle, and that's a very good question, in Chicago at the murder castle, which he built, a labyrinth, diabolical, mad scientist killing machine within the murder castle. We've gone through this. It has acid vats in there. He had a laboratory in there. He had an incinerator, as you mentioned, et cetera. So he was very comfortable in being able to do what he pleased and take his time, et cetera, and he had people that were cleaning up after him. However, he did not have that same convenience in London. In London, he had a room, well, a little more than a room, but it was a rented apartment, if you will, and he did not have the privacy that he had at the murder castle. He was trying to perfect what he was doing in the murder castle on the streets of Whitechapel. And what the progression that you see in the victims becomes extremely prevalent in the final victim, Mary Kelly. Because after he finishes the four victims off, before Mary Kelly, he decides, okay, this is not going to happen out in public. It just can't.
Now, is that because density of population, or was that more so just because he was becoming fearful of getting caught?
It was both, but what he was doing, and according to the crime scene reports, as his as he progressed with his victims, he was taking more chances, and there were even a couple of eyewitness reports that describe him to a T. And he knew that if he were to continue with his murders on the street, it was inevitable he was going to be apprehended.
Can I steer this differently for a moment? I want to kind of pick your brain and see what you believe as far as as far as H.H. Holmes and Jack the Ripper and their or his, you know, which is still kind of up in the air at this point, whether they're one and the same. I mean, there's a buttload of similarities, but you have the most notorious serial killer. Serial killer? Yeah, that too. Yeah. Do you think that people in, let's say, Unterweger, do you think he took off some of his ideas from what was done earlier? Or, you know, even Richard Ramirez, who was doing pretty much the same thing, do you think they picked up some of what they were doing because of what H.H. Holmes and Jack the Ripper had already started nearly 100 years earlier?
There is no doubt that serial killers 100 years ago or contemporary serial killers, they look at the progression of the history of serial killing, and they want to idolize some of these serial killers, and they want to one-up the serial killers of the past and or their mentors, if you will. I have no doubt that they want to not only try to attempt the same things, but to where these serial killers of the past either failed or were caught, the contemporary serial killer wants to succeed. So they have to know everything they can about that serial killer and what their modus operandi was, how they were caught, what the police learned about them and how the police caught them. There's no doubt that they have to know these things. And I interviewed a serial killer when he was going to be caught, and he knew he was going to be caught, he went to take criminal justice classes just so he could learn the mind of the criminal investigator so that he could beat the system. They will go to those lengths. They will go to any length to get that, well, in their mind, that badge of honor of being better and not being caught.
I will honestly call that individual, though, because you do have people like Ted Bundy. Those weren't premeditated. Those weren't it wasn't a lure. It was just something that overcame him emotionally, which there was no study. His killings were based on religion and what he took out of that and what he thought was right or wrong. That wasn't a one-up situation. So, I mean, I will agree with you, and there are certain people that do have that mindset of, like, oh, well, I can do better than that. Do also... There's another side of that to where it doesn't tie in with a competitive streak or anything to do with competition at all. It's maybe a disorder in the brain. You have a dog talking to you saying, go kill this person. There's a lot of levels to it. But I will agree and disagree on different levels.
Okay, now, you brought up Theodore Robert Cowell, Ted Bundy.
Yeah.
Now, he was a serial killer. However, he also was a rapist, a kidnapper, and a necrophile, okay? When you consider all of those things together, I can say, yes, you're right to a degree. Something snaps, and they kill. However, something doesn't snap, and they arbitrarily kidnap and know what's going on throughout the process of kidnapping. Otherwise, they would not be able to kidnap, and so on. Rape, kidnapping, necrophilia, these are things that in your mind, it's a process. You have to process the thought to process the action. Then I have to go back and say, okay, if he can process the thought to process the action on rape and kidnapping and necrophilia, then how much can we say that he just snapped and killed?
Yeah, well, the reason I brought up the barking dog thing is David Berkowitz, the Zodiac Killer. There is no correlation at all with, like, a methodical, like a Holmes or, you know, anything like that in comparison when it comes to the serial killer aspect. Like, the dude just lost his shit. I mean...
Yeah, he just flipped shit one day and started a spree.
He did become methodical, though. And when he would do his killings, and he would also let the authorities know due to the fact that he wanted to be caught. He didn't want, he didn't know why he was doing this thing. But, I mean, he also suffered from bouts of schizophrenia. And... when he'd have an episode, his episodes would last for a week to a week and a half to where he'd submit, these people have to, they have to be punished. And he'd send a letter to the authorities first, put a city on lockdown. So he was more of a terrorist serial killer, but it wasn't initially planned. He was sending a letter to the police. He was reaching out to be caught. But he was going to carry it out no matter what.
Yeah, I mean, whether it was a traveler or what. And that's what I'm trying to understand is the correlation between, you know, all of these variables and, you know, our... essentially the first known serial killer, or at least the most notorious first known. You know, what one thing in all of these people's minds is the correlating factor? Now, see, you know, we've all heard about, you know, oh, such and such asylum. You know, they had all these jars of brains up on the shelves. How phenomenal would it be to have all of these individuals' brains in jars and try to look at the chemical makeup in them and see just what went whack?
Right, but I think Matt could even agree on this. Matt has had some training in, what was it, Matt, psychology?
Yeah, it was abnormal psychology and sociology. Was what I
okay, and
my degree.
I think you can agree on this. I think you can agree on this, that There is no one thing. There's no way to say that you can pigeonhole all these serial killers and say that there is one common factor, or there is one area of the brain that has gone bad. There's not one single thing that you can actually pinpoint as the point of origin.
Yeah, no, I'll 100% agree with that.
Each and every, you know, and you can look at one individual and they'll have very little education and they'll go out and they'll go on a killing rampage and you'll find out that they were living on the street and they just wanted to just end their lives. So with that, they wanted to take 100 or, that's ridiculous, but 18 of their lives with them because they woke up that morning and they had a bad day and they were tired of going on anymore and they were homeless. And then you have someone like Dr. H.H. Holmes, who a highly educated, learned doctor who killed between 200 and 500 people.
And how many are on record? 15?
No, he admitted to 27.
Yeah. But last report that I saw is when, of the 27, there was only, I think it was 15 or 17 were confirmed.
Confirmed.
That he
right.
Yeah, that he was the culprit. It wasn't the full 27 when they accused
right.
him. They accused him of 200.
Right, and how many was he convicted of?
I think, well, during the conviction, he was convicted of 27, right?
No, how many did he go to the noose for?
Oh,
he went to the hangman's noose.
When he went to the hangman's noose, dude, you hit me out of left field on that one. I knew it, and it just popped out of my head. We've talked about this in person, so you know I know it. It just, I wasn't thinking you were going to hit me with that question.
Benjamin Peisel.
Yes.
His son Howard and his daughter Nellie.
Yeah.
And that was it.
Yeah, I knew it was in, it was in the single digits. I think, or tell me if I'm wrong on this, back then, even if it was one or two, he was still going to go to the news.
Correct. Now, do you know that although it's stated that he was hung for the murders of Benjamin Peitzel, Howard and Nellie Peitzel, in essence, the court's records indicated that he was only hung for the murder of Benjamin Peitzel. Nellie and Howard, Benjamin's children, were added after he was hung.
That I did not
find. As they saw no reason to bring court action against him since he was already dead, hung.
I'm going to step us back a few minutes into the conversation and go back to Ted Bundy. One of our listeners in the chat stated, and this is from Renee Blake, who's in Auckland, New Zealand, Ted Bundy did not just snap. He set out to hunt down his victims and even planned what he wanted to do to them. This was due to his childhood when he found out his sister was in fact his mother, and then later his love of his life rejected him. Are there any correlating factors similar to that in the history that we know for H.H. Holmes, either in England or here in the U.S. as far as the being rejected?
H.H. Holmes, Herman Webster Mudgett, his mother was very, very religious. And he was very close to his mother. there were never two words ever known that were bad spoken between the two of them. He loved his mother very much and her him. His father was a very staunch he was the one who would set the laws and keep them. At one time, his father was a prominent man in Gilmanton. He was running Gilmanton, New Hampshire. And he had an air about him that he was the man to get things done and got things done. And although Herman respected his father, he respected him enough to keep an arm's distance from him. Now, there were stories I came through when I was researching various stories that aren't even worth mentioning about episodes between Herman and his father. And I didn't see much stock in them. The sources didn't seem credible. And the only thing that I found was that Herman not being as close to his father as his mother, he did experience something in his life as a child. When he saw the town of Gilmanton basically steal his father's wealth from him, take the property from him that he owned, many, tens of hundreds of acres. And he basically saw his father decline from being a wealthy, prominent man who held this entire town of Gilmanton together to becoming a pauper. His father went through a period of being ridiculed, feeling rejected, and he turned to the bottle. And this is well documented. At the time, there's more about it, more details about it in my book. And Herman vowed at that point. And this was Herman's big turning point in his life. Herman vowed at that point that he was going to make it his life's mission to vindicate what happened to his father. And the way he would do that is by getting even with every human being he had ever come across for the remaining years of his life in whatever fashion and form he could come up with.
So it wasn't a snap that put him on the path to become one of the world's most notorious serial killers. Why do I keep wanting to say serial killers? Damn it.
Serial killers.
Yes, he was killer.
Mm-hmm.
But, so it wasn't just a snap. It wasn't a, I mean, this was a long, drawn out. Well, let me ask you this.
Holmes was made. He was made. It was not a snap. He was made. There was an incident as a child after this happened, and it's, again, detailed in my book. For the last 100 years, people have been passing around this story about Herman being thrown into the town doctor's office and his classmates had been ruffians, and they threw him in this town doctor's office and pulled a skeleton down on top of them to scare them. And, you know, they alleged that that's how he was just enamored by that skeleton, and that made him just become interested in death and so on. Well, that's a bunch of hooey. That town doctor, Dr. Nahum White, his name was lost in history. Took a whole lot of research to find that. Actually, a member of the Mudgett family purchased his home and his doctor's office in Gillington, and they invited me to read and use Dr. Nahum White's personal diary and excerpts from it for my book, whereas Dr. White gives detailed accounts of training young Herman in the art of preparing cadavers. Hence, Herman was made. Dr. H.H. Holmes evolved.
Now, looking back through all of the other serial killers, like Ramirez that I mentioned, Unterweger, guys like that, do you think they actually had this, I guess you would say this predestined thing that it was going to become their way of life early on, or was it something that, you know, totally different from H.H. Holmes, who, you know, he was pretty much going to become this from early on, this monster. Do you think guys like Unterweger and Ramirez and the, you know, there's just a myriad of different ones. Even the family that you have mentioned before, you know, even they, well, they were doing it more as crimes of opportunity and profit, I believe, correct?
Yes. And vengeance. Now, let's take a look since you brought up Ramirez. Okay? And, you know, he's passed on now, and it couldn't have happened to a better guy. Let's look at him. You know, my personal feeling is there are cases where an individual can snap, and I'll give you a perfect example. In a case of self-defense, if I'm pushed up against a wall and somebody's coming at me and I have to protect my family, I am going to snap. And I can and I will use everything necessary, including lethal force, to stop the perpetrator from harming my family. In that case, yes, you snap. Some people don't even know that they killed the perpetrator until after they have, just to protect their family. That, to me, I believe is justified. I would rather be judged by 12 than carried by 6, okay? Now, you take Ramirez, okay? His father was Mexican national. His mother, she was a policeman. But later, after she lost her job on the police force, she was a laborer with the Santa Fe Railroad. His dad, it was documented that he always beat his kids, used vigorous physical abuse. as a result, twice Ramirez ended up with two very serious head injuries. He had to be hospitalized. One injury was when he was 2 years old. He had to have 30 stitches to close it on his head. Okay. He was prone to epileptic seizures because of the injuries to his head. These are things physically that happened to him. But he was scarred emotionally as well from those things with his father. Through those things, he became a serial killer, rapist. He was burglarizing homes. He was arrested for home invasion and burglary. And he was arrested for those things while he was raping and killing. They just didn't put the pieces together until after he was released for the burglary and home invasion. Again, does a burglar enter an individual's home because he snaps?
Does a burglar?
It is a process that they go through in their mind. They're going to break into the house because they want something. They're going to get something. The same reason why they violate a woman. They want something. They're going to get something.
Well, it's also in a lot of cases, not saying everyone, but it's a affirmation of power. It's an entitlement of power.
Correct.
But that's a lot of that you see more in like what they call not even like a serial case, but in a crime of passion. It's an entitlement thing. So they feel they believe that they deserve what they do, but reverting back to like a David Berkowitz, that's completely opposite.
Right, and you know what I love about these guys? You know, Richard Ramirez, he fatally stabbed a 79-year-old woman to death.
Yes.
Okay. He didn't walk up to Vin Diesel, 6'4", and 285 pounds stacked with muscle, because he was going to get his ass kicked. With a knife, or even a gun. Shoot Vin Diesel 4 times, he's still coming. You know? These guys prey on people who are weaker than them, to put a notch in their badge of honor that they believe that they have.
Well, yeah, you're not going to go for and attack somebody who can clearly take you.
Okay, but then let me ask you this. If we are going to contend that they snap, why do they snap on a 79-year-old woman and not Vin Diesel? If you snap, you're going to snap on whomever, right?
Yeah, but there's still some level of rational thought.
Well, there we go. Look, rational thought. So then are you snapping or do you have rational thought? Because there's a huge difference.
Well, yeah, no, I agree with that. There is. But when you snap, your mind is subconsciously going to work in a way to say, well, if I snap on that person, that's just not going to work.
Okay, so if I say to myself, I'm going to snap on the 79-year-old woman because, you know I can get away with it. But if I snap on Vin Diesel standing over there 5 feet away, I know I'm getting my ass kicked. Is that or is that not the process of logical thinking?
The way I'm thinking
is you cannot justify snapping if there is a logical thought process.
There's a gray area though when it comes to that kind of stuff, to where self-preservation
not that,
will.
Not that gray.
It's not that gray. But there is a self-preservation aspect to it. You look at somebody and you're like, I probably won't get away with that, but I can get away with this.
And
that's for the rest.
Right, and we're full circle right back to Jack the Ripper and his progression of his victims.
Well, and Dan, we've talked about this before too, is you also have to keep in mind, and you do, and we've talked about this a lot, but for people listening, the morality wasn't there like it is now, to where even up to anybody that's been more recent. I mean, the morality back at the turn of the century for human life isn't what it was now. And there were still duels. There were still, you know, flat-out murders that people would walk away from and be like, oh, well, you know, I shot him. He didn't hit me. I win. So
right,
a
and
lot
understand
of the...
That this is a time shortly after the plague had taken a lot of people's lives, and it was normal to see carts with, you know, 15 bodies on it going down the street. That, you know, little children would see that, you know.
Yeah. And
so
when you
I
have
agree
somebody
with you
like, when you have somebody like Holmes also, that was a staple in the community, was very, very well respected, was very, very well followed by the medical community. Just because he was so charismatic, you don't get that, oh, well, maybe he's got some shit in his basement. Or, but that thought process, thinking in a turn-of-the-century person, kind of goes out the window. It's like,
well,
the mayor was one of his good friends. But then again, Chicago politics has always been horrible. So
yeah, and you know, unfortunately, that's one of the things that we do. And I even include myself in that, even though I am a researcher, historian, and an author, is we take these not only crimes, but we take these events from bygone years, and we look at them through the perspective of now, the here and now, through our eyes, not realizing what was going on back then.
And that's kind of why I bring it up every show that we do about it, is I think a lot of people question what happened back then with a now mentality versus a back then mentality.
Right.
Now here's another question for you. What was the progression of brutality from the first believed victim of Jack the Ripper? I mean, they were all looked at as being the same M.O. Did he practice on 2, 4, 10 before he got to where he was at, where they tied those together. You know, was there the sloppy practice killing prior to him getting better at it, where they could say, okay, these are all under the same MO? I mean, if we're only blaming him for X many as Jack the Ripper, how many were done that they didn't blame on Jack the Ripper because they didn't match and he hadn't decided upon his MO?
Let's put it this way. From 1888 to 1892, there were a total of 27 murders committed in and around the Whitechapel area of London that were attributed to Jack the Ripper. Any murder where they did not have a suspect, anything that looked like it could have been Jack the Ripper, they basically said, this is our guy, Jack the Ripper. He did this one. Now, over the years, they took another look and they said, well, you know, through the process of elimination, through research, through investigation, and people coming forward claiming they killed this one, they killed that one, or whatnot, and also confessions in court and so on, eyewitness reports, they were able to eliminate 22 of those cases. They were not Jack the Ripper killings, which brings us to the canonical five. The other 22, for reasons and more reasons, were listed as not relating to Jack the Ripper. They just did not fit the mold. Now, when you look at the Jack the Ripper cases, starting, you know, on 31st of August, Marianne Nichols, and then you have in September, you've got Ann Chapman and Elizabeth Stride, and on the same day as Elizabeth Stride, Catherine Meadows. Then after the two on the same day, the killer decides, okay, we're going to do things indoors. And on November 9th, Mary Jane Kelly is found in the room.
Well,
okay, so
real quick, Mary Kelly was the, and this is my own personal idea of the tie-in with Holmes being the Ripper. If you look at the murder castle of what he did to the bodies behind closed doors, and you look at Mary Kelly, Mary Kelly was noted as the most aggressive attack of any of those. And it's because he had more time. The fourth killing of those five was done in broad daylight, which there's a ton of evidence to back up that he was basically interrupted to do, or his intent was to do more damage to that body than the...
Okay, what do we know about all four victims that were out found outside? What is the correlation that we know?
They were all prostitutes.
Okay, but let's just look at forensic evidence. Okay? That in itself is evidence that ties them together. But forensic evidence, let's look at forensic evidence of all four, Mary Ann Polly Nichols, Ann Chapman, Elizabeth Stride, and Catherine Eddowes. When we look at the four autopsy reports, forensic evidence, you have identical cut throats. You have identical cuts on the torso and the opening of the torso. And you have a thumb and handprint bruise on the lower jaw. And that's on every of the each of the four victims. Now, one thing we do know of Holmes, how did Holmes subdue his victims? What was one of the methods as a pharmacist and chemist? What was one of the methods Holmes used to subdue his victims?
He was gassing them.
Oh, it was also strangulation.
No. He was using something on a rag that he would place on her face. What was it?
Yeah, he was using chloroform, but he was also using gas piped into their unit in the murder castle.
Right, but you cannot use gas outside. However, with Holmes being an expert chemist, and there is a report, again, I hate to sound like a broken record, it's in my book, there is a report of Holmes having perfected a chloroform that was untraceable. And maybe you have heard about it. But every one of the victims, the four victims I mentioned, has those same, that same handprint, the same bruises on their face.
But most of H.H.'s bodies were never found.
Correct.
Between the acid vats in the basement, the incinerators, the brick company, and everything else. So how many,
correct,
how many actual bodies did they attribute to H.H.? Were they actually retained a body?
Where they that said that they know that he used the chloroform? They know that he used the chloroform on Benjamin Peitzel. And when they questioned him about it,
was executed for.
Yes, and when they questioned him about it, he said that's how he would often employ the use of chloroform, specifically the brand that he had perfected that was untraceable on many of his victims. He bragged about it.
Now, is this supposed untraceable chloroform still marketable today?
Oh, I highly doubt it. And if it is, I mean, right now, you can actually go online and buy chloroform today, but you're going to have a pharmaceutical license or a doctor's license in order to buy it.
You know, see, to me, the chloroform is just about as useless and has only one purpose, and it rates right up there to me with the roofie drug.
But back
if
then,
you're going to go to the doctor and they have to put you under, they're going to use something more than that. But, of course,
but understand,
the century,
back then, what did a doctor use back then to anesthetize their patients?
Yeah, they used chloroform to anesthetize for heavy dental procedures and things like that. I do understand that, but it's still, the purpose for it still being marketed today or manufactured today makes no logic to me. That's like us still manufacturing phosgene gas, mustard gas. We don't do it. Why? Because we have so many better things. Why would they still market chloroform today?
Well, I believe it's been refined, and I believe that the main use for it today is for animals.
They,
from
they
what
still
I read.
Use it. Well, that and also it's more used in dentistry and minor cases in the an actual medical procedure because there's no contents in it that have any allergic reaction.
Right.
So, I mean, yeah, if you need a tooth pulled and you have a nitrous oxide allergy to it, yeah, they're not going to use it, but they can use chloroform. It's more used in vapor situations now other than, like, actually just throw it on a rag and throw it on your face and you're under and done. But, no, it's still used in the medical profession. Not often, but it is still used.
Now, of all of the 200-plus that HH is thought to have killed during the World's Fair,
correct,
how many bodies were actually recovered total?
Here's the thing. In every piece of evidence or article that you can find talking about the excavation of the grounds at the glass factory that he owned, where there was an incinerator there that he used to dispose of remains, etc., and of the murder castle. A few days into the trial, the police, who were still trying to clean up after the World's Fair, were so inundated with other business, they knew they had the murderer behind Iron Gate, and they saw what an enormous project it would be to have to dig up the entire murder castle and or dig up the entire area surrounding the glass factory. They did not have the resources or the manpower. And I have one document where one of the workers, he's a policeman, a Chicago Police Department at that time, he said it was so overwhelming, they just could not deal with it anymore. They found some bones. What happened to them bones, nobody knows. They were delivered to the coroner's office. From there, we have no idea. But they're still believed to be bones of victims located at the site of the glass factory in Chicago and at the site of Holmes' murder castle in Chicago on 63rd and Wallace, where there is a United States Post Office currently built.
Yeah, which is making things difficult.
Yes. You can't just take a shovel and go over there and dig. You know.
I just want to take a few voice recorders and cameras.
Right? Actually, we did that.
It's also not an area that you want to go in if you're not from Chicago. You don't want to take a chance.
No, if you're not from Chicago, no.
Wallet.
No. You're not from Chicago, no. And do not go there at night. Let's just say that there are a lot of gangs. There are a lot of territorial things. And you really don't want to be caught there at night.
No.
Okay, so I'm going to ask both of you, right? Go ahead.
No, truthfully, under no circumstance should you go in that area at night or, hell, even during the day.
No, during the day you're okay as long as you're with a group.
Well, that's what I was going to say. If you're with a big group of people, fine, but otherwise, independently, you do not want to go snooping around. It's not because the postal workers are going to go postal. It's the locals that might go postal on you.
Yeah. And with my big group, do you mean, you know, badges and firearms?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, it did. I mean, the whole thing is fascinating to me that, you know, now, the White City, how many do they think he was able to lure from the White City back to the murder castle?
Between 200 and 500.
All right, now, his murder castle was actually utilized as a rooming house, correct?
Pardon me?
The murder castle was actually utilized also as a rooming house, correct?
I'm sorry, as a what house?
Boarding house, rooming house?
It was actually a hotel. It was a hotel. It was the World's Fair Hotel.
Okay.
Yeah,
well,
that's
the
World's Fair Hotel.
And that's what I'm getting at. How many? Yeah, and how many checked in there that weren't
didn't check
even,
out?
Well, no, that weren't even thought to be missing, or that, you know, just went missing with nobody looking for them. I mean, the roughly 200 to 500 that they know are the ones that people looked for those individuals. How many actually checked into the hotel that nobody would look for anyway?
Thousands. Understand that this was the biggest fair in the world at the time, and it drew hundreds of thousands of people from all over the world. And just a short few minute train ride would take you from the World's Fair, from the very front of the World's Fair to the front door of the World's Fair Hotel, the Murder Castle. And every day he had full capacity. And he had to keep up a legitimate business as he was also using it to feed his morbid desires.
Well, and also, for people who don't know, I want to explain a little bit about the World's Fair, just a couple sentences and that's it. The World's Fair would, like, we called it the World's Fair in the United States because there was venues from all over the world that were selling products. It was kind of like a huge scale and huge promoted flea market for different things, whether it was trinkets, it was something you had to have, it was something you needed. And when the Chicago World Fair was going off, that was the, and Dane, correct me if I'm wrong, that was the introduction of the world's first Ferris wheel, right? On U.S.
Yes,
soil?
It was. Yes. Yep. Yep, it was.
So,
and it was not only that, Nikola Tesla, he had come here. He is a physicist and engineer. He came here. The World's Fair is where he introduced to the entire world alternating current electricity. That's where electricity was introduced, was at the World's Fair. Had it not been for that and Nikola Tesla bringing that, who knows how long it would have been before they had alternating current.
Yeah, and they still have World Fairs, and there was one in St. Louis, the gateway to the West. They had them in L.A. They had them in San Francisco. I mean, there were ones after the Chicago one. The Chicago one was particular because the city actually built a full array courtyard of, they were kind of shyster buildings. They didn't really have any integrity or anything like that. And there's still a couple of museums that were involved. There's also the main statue that is still in the courtyard of what was the original White City. Everything was made out of either marble or aggregate at that time to make it appear to be more prestigious than it actually was. But, yeah, there are still a couple buildings that are there. But, yes, Dane is absolutely correct. It was a short train ride. It was public transportation was running back then. The one thing that Holmes was amazing at was picking out, like he said, at capacity, but picking out his specific victims. And this is where, in my opinion, it ties into the Jack the Ripper. It was people who nobody would really kind of think about looking for, either immigrants that were kind of fresh off the boat, same thing as what the Whitechapel Ripper did, Jack the Ripper, is quote-unquote, or I guess, a.k.a. H.H. Holmes, if you want to tie them together, they were streetwalkers that were independent. Nobody really knew about them. There's kind of a tie-in with the M.O., if you will. But the one thing that, and Dane, you're absolutely right, the one thing that Holmes had at the murder castle was a lot more time to do what he wanted to do.
And with that, what I'd like to do, because we've only got like about 15 minutes remaining, I want to ask both of you, what exactly do you think was the Ripper's purpose for Mary Kelly, the Ripper's final victim, Mary Kelly? Why was she murdered indoors? Now, I want to hear both of you, and then I'm going to give you my take, what I know to be what I've researched and put in the book.
Dennis, if you want to field that first.
Yeah,
sure,
yeah,
I want to
hear
you guys
first. I'll field it first simply because I know I'm probably going to be wrong, but I'm going to say that he was already had his travel date set, already knew that he was at great risk of being caught now because he was being sought so heavily. And he wanted to take his time to kind of perfect what he did to the body. I think he wanted to be able to shield himself from sight, whereas the others were just, you know, out in the middle of the damn darkened streets, which, you know, an oil lamp candle is not sufficient light. I think he wanted better lighting and wanted to shield himself from being found. Matt, feel free.
Okay, Matt.
I didn't know if you were thinking up something else or I was waiting for Dane to respond before.
No, Dane already said he's going to let both of us and then he's going to give what he has from his research. Follow the conversation, man. Where the hell are you?
I'm following the conversation. I don't know if you had anything else that you were thinking of or wanting to add, or Dane was going to chime in and say something, so I gave a second. I'm sorry. But no, with the Mary Kelly killing, that one is, it's unique. I don't know if there were, it wasn't a crime of passion because they really didn't have any bond between themselves before it. What I do possibly think, I have two different scenarios in my head. I know we're running shorter on time, so I won't get into both before you can say, but the one that pops in my head all the time is I agree with Dennis in a lot of ways, is he may have felt rushed, but at the same time, there was a lot of aggression involved in the slaying, which I don't know if he was trying to train another apprentice. Also, thirdly, it could have been just one of those things to where, hey, I'm going to try and throw people off the trail. I don't know. There is a bunch of different directions that it could go, and unfortunately, none of us will ever truly, truly know because we don't know the mentality that not saying it's Holmes, but the person who did it. That one actually has me baffled. That's one I have to do a lot more research into and been trying to do a lot more research into to find out definitively, in my own opinion, what I think about it.
All right, well, I'm going to interject real quick before you get your chance, Dane. Renee Blake is in chat with us, and she states, wasn't it thought that JTR is thought to be harvesting body parts? Isn't that what Holmes did as well? Seems pretty much a good correlation to me. What's your take on that one? Were all the organs not with the victims from JTR's cases?
This is a correlation to body parts, okay? However,
Oh, this is not a good time to break up, Dane. Go back to where you were sitting before. You're breaking up on us.
What's that?
You're breaking up. I don't know where you
were.
But go back to where you were at the beginning of the show. Sit down.
yeah, I haven't moved, but how's that?
That's better.
All right. Okay. All right, I actually moved my phone over by the window. Okay. There's actually a stronger correlation that I want to get to. Now, just to throw this out there, food for thought. 31st of August when Marianne Nichols was murdered, Annie Chapman was murdered on the 8th of September. There's 8 days in between. Annie Chapman and Elizabeth Stride, who was murdered on the 30th of September, there is 21 days in between. 30th of September to the 9th of November when Mary Jane Kelly was murdered, there's 8 days in between. What's the correlation there? I don't know if there is one. I wasn't able to make one. I'm just throwing that out there because I know Matt loves numbers.
No, not me.
No. Now, to go on to Mary Kelly. When you look at her autopsy report, her right arm, which was removed from her body, and it was resting on a mattress. And I'm sorry because this is going to be a little graphic for your listeners. Now, her elbow was bent. Her legs were pulled apart. And her thigh would be, all the muscle, the tissue was removed from her thigh. Everything from her pubic area up in her groin area was removed. A cut went straight up her torso to her neck, and it made a T. And her breasts were removed. Her torso was opened up. The tissues on her neck were severed all the way down to the bone to where her head was just barely hanging on by a thread. They found her uterus and kidneys and one breast under her head. The other breast and her liver, well, one breast was found by her foot, and her liver was found between her feet. Her intestines and everything that they pulled out from inside of her were laid by her right side. The flaps that were removed from her abdomen and the thigh tissue and muscles, were laying on a table. Everything, including her bed clothing, was just saturated in blood. The entire floor was just a pool of blood. The walls were splattered in blood. Her face was just gashed to pieces. Her nose, her cheeks, her eyebrows, and her ears were removed. Now, you can just picture the carnage.
Sounds like practice.
Well,
no, that's
training.
I want to give you a little food for thought. When you get a copy of my book, and you will, you'll
and
be reading.
Will better be autographed.
You'll be reading a section on articulating a human skeleton. When you articulate a human skeleton, you have to remove the intestines, etc., as much flesh as you can from the areas to prepare the bones. And you do it in certain steps, like you remove the thigh tissue before you remove from the knee down. You do it in sections so as to protect the bones, because each bone has to be taken care of in a specific manner so that you do not cause cuts into the bone, etc. And yes, it is a bloody mess. Now, mind you, there was no laboratory table in the room to where these articles could be placed. And if you're kneeling over a body and you're preparing it for articulation, you are going to be setting certain articles like the intestines next to the body, especially when the bed is up against the wall like the bed was that Mary Kelly was laying on. Now, in the report, we're told that a man, an individual, and his name is listed, it's in the book, had stood outside the window, and he was laying upon the wall. He gave a time and so on. He had to give a count of what he heard and if he heard anything. Very well could be that this is the time when the preparation for articulation was halted out of fear of being caught, because even the curtains were splattered with blood. The Metropolitan Police couldn't even walk in the room. When they opened the door and they saw what happened, they all stepped outside the room and they waited for Scotland Yard to arrive for anyone to enter the room, because it was so revolting.
Yeah, but real quick, though, doesn't that seem like more of an aggression killing than anything else, due to the fact that wasn't Holmes' departure from what you found? Wasn't Holmes' departure like 3 days after Mary Kelly was found?
It was.
That's not
however,
time
we know
to,
that.
Gentlemen, I'm going to have to interrupt real quick. We have 3.5 minutes left. I want to make sure that we get to finish this part of the conversation with the current listeners that have been so enthralled so far. Make sure to call in at 323-580-5703 You can listen into the remainder of the conversation even after we go to archive. Because at 11 o'clock here in about 2 minutes and 50 seconds, we're going to go off air, and it'll roll into the archive. Now, you're welcome to listen in on archive, but if you'd like to listen to the rest of this conversation live, dial in at 323-580-5703. Dane, given that we have 2.5 minutes, throw out the plugs that you want to get out there, my friend.
Okay, if you want to go to Amazon, just plug my name in, Dane Ladwig, D-A-N-E-L-A-D-W-I-G. List of my books come on up, and Dr. H.H. Holmes and Whitechapel Ripper will pop up. And there's a website dedicated to the book. It's holmestheripper.com. And also, we didn't get to it, but there's a video, a YouTube video, listed under Dr. H.H. Holmes and Whitechapel Ripper, and it has made history. It is the first video book trailer from an independent author who has listed a video book trailer that has gone well over 400,000 views in 6 months. And it, to me, was very exciting. And I want to thank all the listeners for listening in.
I definitely thank you for that, and I definitely want to thank the listeners as well. And I will say this, Renee, I know you're dialing in or listening in from New Zealand. Thank you very much for putting us global on another week. We've had London, we've had Canada, I've seen South America, and now we can put New Zealand in there as well as a specific point. Thank you very much. I will tell you that the archive will be available by daybreak anyway.
London, Canada, and New Zealand. You didn't even tell me you guys were going global with this tonight.
Well, oh, yeah. That's just the way we roll, Big Daddy.
That's awesome.
Thank you so much for listening. We have 30 seconds left on live, then it will roll to archive. Dane, don't leave us. Ladies and gentlemen, catch Matt and myself at CPR Matt, CPR Dennis on Facebook and Twitter. You can also catch Chicagoland Paranormal Researchers.com and the Facebook. Tune in next week. I believe we have a fantastic paranormal investigation team, and we are going to archive now, but thank you so much for listening. Now, Dane, back to the dateline of when the last body was found, and 3 days later, JTR is on a boat leaving London?
Correct. Leaving, he was going to be leaving the USA. I'm sorry, let me think here.
Leaving London to come back to the USA.
Leaving London to come back to the USA. Where I was getting confused is because right before they had arrested him for, actually it wasn't even murder of Benjamin Peitzel or suspicion of murder, they had arrested him originally for insurance fraud. He had the tickets in his hand. He was scheduled to leave the USA to go to London to evade being caught in the USA, and that was prior to his conviction.
The problem I have with the Mary Kelly one is if he was trying to do what he was doing here, he wouldn't. Like, there would have been no way to bring a skeleton, articulated or not, back to the States.
No. But now,
what happened to Mary Kelly, she, like, that was more of a mutilation. That I know for a fact you've seen the photos of what happened to her.
Oh, yes.
That there's
let me ask you
no...
this.
Okay.
Let me ask you this, and I know it's difficult to equate the two, very difficult. Your car breaks down. You find out it's the water pump. You can't carry the whole car home. You can't take it on the bus. But you realize you got a backpack. You can take that water pump off because you realize it's the water pump that blew. You can take it off and throw it in a backpack, take it home, get another water pump, go back to your car and fix it, correct? Would you agree with that?
Yeah.
No. Now, in articulating a skeleton, the bones are separate. Holmes was so skilled in articulating. In 20 years plus plating skeletons, he did not need a diagram, a puzzle, a map, or anything to put those bones back together. To grab a sheet, put those bones in there, walk out, go back to wherever, articulate that skeleton, and take it into a university or medical center, which we know he did. We have the facts of him selling articulated skeletons in London at the Royal London Infirmary at the time.
Now, I know you've looked at the ship manifests.
Yes.
Boarding and disembarking.
Mm-hmm.
My understanding is there was a gentleman in London that boarded the vessel, Henry Mudgett, but he never got off the vessel. But someone named H.H. Holmes got off the vessel. Is that accurate, what I understood occurred there?
Yes and no. I heard that same story. I searched and searched for those manifests. I came across the one of Henry Mudgett boarding. However, back then, understand, you did not have to show a boarding pass to disembark.
Yeah, you just got off the boat. Big deal.
Exactly. Exactly. Okay. And you would not have to have, they didn't care who was leaving the U.S. at the time to go overseas. They really didn't. All you did is give your name. There were no passports with your picture on it. I'm John Smith. And this is my wife, Mrs. John Smith. And that's why when you look at the boarding pad, the manifest, many of them are listed as such. It'll say Dr. John Johnson and his butler.
Yeah,
because that's all
no matter what his name was.
Right.
And additionally, much like right now, my great-great-grandfather came over from Germany. I was able to actually track him back coming into Ellis Island based on timelines.
Well, that's what I was going to get to. Coming back.
Okay, go ahead.
You had to have a notary that reflected who you were. You had to have a notary stamp on a document that reflected who you were. They wouldn't let you back on the boat to come back to the U.S. You couldn't get off in Ellis Island without having that notary stamp on a credential that said, I'm Henry Howard Holmes. Without having a notary stamp, you are not getting off that bus. You're going directly back getting off that boat. You're going directly back on that boat to London. And that's why you will not find manifest for leaving one port and getting off of the boat at the next port. What you'll find is leaving and coming back.
That's what I was kind of wondering, too, is I haven't looked into this. I've looked into a lot of the travel aspect of it, but for patrons that were on the boat on the way back, I'm sure there were immigrants that had to go through Ellis Island, and they did account for every single person that was on that ship coming into the U.S. And I'm wondering what alias was used.
I'm sorry, run it past me again.
Well, if Holmes left the States and went to England, there's not going to be a ledger, or if there was a ledger, it was just a general ledger of who was getting off the boat. But with the amount of aliases that Holmes had, when he got on the boat to come back to the States, I'm sure there were probably immigrants there that they had to count for everybody, whether it was Ellis Island or one of the major seaports, that he had to pass through and register at some point under one of his, what, seven aliases?
Well, understand this, too. And he had over two dozen aliases. But understand this, too. Holmes employed and made sure that every girl that he employed as his assistant was a notary. And he paid for them to be a notary, and they had to agree to be a notary so that any document he wanted notarized, including traveling passes, they would notarize.
And no matter how much bullshit was on it.
Exactly.
True.
And they notarized all legal documents, or what they thought were legal documents, going to insurance companies to be defrauded as well.
Now, let me ask you this. With all the research that you've done on HH, I realize they didn't really have, now we have like Mensa that does testing and understands what the IQ is and understands that, this is average and blah, blah, blah. Did they have anything of that time, in that time frame, where they could categorize his intellectual level?
Not to my knowledge, and if they did, he would have surpassed the average man easily, and he'd probably been in the top, I would have to say, the top one percentile.
That's what I was thinking, was, with all of the, not just the conceptual ideas that he had, but the actual planning, the just everything that this man did was based on extremely high intellect, and he pulled it off so well that they were only able to prosecute him on one murder.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. That he's accused of between 200 and 500. That takes an extremely high IQ level to be able to not only skirt the system and get away from it and not be found out.
Right.
Well, granted, it does take a sick son of a bitch to do that.
Well, right.
If he were to actually test out today, I know Mensa says that at 140 you qualify for Mensa membership. Where do you think he would have tested? With all the research and everything that you've done and the countless hours, where do you think he would have tested numbers-wise?
What is the top number?
I think Mensa caps at 190.
190, he would have came in probably around 185.
Awesome.
Between that 185 and 187, somewhere around there. This guy was super intelligent. This man could run the United States if he wanted to.
horribly.
Well, no. If he would have channeled all his charisma, his intelligence, and everything that he used to carry out vengeance, if he would have channeled all that to doing good, he could have easily ran the United States.
See, I think it would be more of a dictatorship than anything else, though.
Yeah,
well,
look,
if you didn't vote the way he wanted,
look at Hitler. Right.
Well, yeah. Well, Hitler was genius.
Right.
He was brilliant.
Yes, he was.
In a sad,
no, he was eccentric.
Way. No, he was brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
He truly was.
Yep.
But it was in such a sick and twisted way that it went the wrong side of what you and I consider good.
Okay, and who else does that sound like?
Obama?
Dr. H.H. Holmes.
Oh, Holmes, yeah.
Oh.
I was waiting for that. I was waiting for somebody to say it.
I couldn't, yeah. I couldn't skip that one. But now, what I wanted to talk to you about, like I said earlier, there's some other cases and other serial killers that intrigue me. But I want to know what your research is, if any. Now, I know you have the new book, but I want to know if you've studied Richard Ramirez, Unterweger, Green River Killer. Have you studied any of those characters yet?
I've looked into them, but not much in depth. Naturally, because of writing serial killers anthology and writing about Holmes and Ripper, they're serial killers. Naturally, I keep up on or interested in researching serial killers. But they interest me. They interest me, yes.
Well, the one person who does a lot more with Ben, Dane, not saying that you don't, but a lot more that does with diversity is John Borowski.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I have a lot of respect for him.
I'm not familiar with him, sir. And since I have, a author that has studied serial killers, I can ask him because I'm talking to him. I don't know John Borowski, and maybe we need to see about getting him on to find out about these other serial killers. And maybe, Dane, if you'll go along with this, we can get you and Borowski on and talk about all of them and what eccentricities seem to correlate one to the other in some small fashion.
I think that'd be a good show. If you can get even a few more.
Even John Stevenson. That'd be a lot of John.
It doesn't take a whole shitload of us to fill a 2-hour show. So if we get any people online, nobody's going to get anything for information.
Right.
I think it would be fascinating because,
John Borowski is
fascination. Go ahead, Matt.
All right. Thank you. John Borowski is local to Dane and I. He's out of the Chicago area. He's done a lot of work with Holmes. He did what was the most recent one he did? The guy from
Carl Pendrin.
Yeah. So
who?
He's
Carl Panzram, you know who he is? Carl Panzram.
No, it doesn't ring a bell. Sorry.
Carl Panzram he's
a brutal
sex fuck.
Yeah. Oh, big time. Big time.
So remember the
level with Jack the Ripper?
No, he's way more twisted.
Yeah.
Jack the Ripper was pretty much a sick fuck.
Yeah. Panzeran was worse. Do you remember the Ghost Adventures episode they did on the lighthouse where they used to drown people?
Point of Rocks Lighthouse. Yeah.
Yeah, Carl Panzeran.
Point of Rocks.
Carl Panzeran was drowned on those rocks.
Mm-hmm.
He molested and raped, self-proclaimed, I don't think it was actually documented, but self-proclaimed over 2,000 men. He used to steal ships and cruise up and down. What's up?
Men and boys.
Yeah. Dude, he was a
sick
fuck.
But it wasn't just raping them. Wasn't even just raping them. It was sadistic, just binding them and torturing them while he's raping them and being raped by them as well, demanding to be raped by them. Yeah, he was totally sadistic.
So he wasn't just a serial killer. He was a control freak, sadistic. We all have that thought in afternoon traffic where I'd love to drag that son of a bitch out of his car and just beat him, rip his leg off and beat him to death with the bloody end of it. But what causes somebody to go off that far deep end? Is it a chemical imbalance in the brain, do you suppose? Is it upbringing? Is it environmental? Is it chemical? I mean, to go to the extremes that some of these serial killers have done, and I guess even if you want to take it to that level, the mall shooter, the school shooter, any of those, I wonder if there's a way that we can check, serotonin levels in the brain or something, and find some correlation between all of them.
I'm not sure you're going to be able to find anything.
I mean, it just baffles me as, somebody that doesn't research these people and doesn't look into their pasts and everything. It just baffles me how a human can be that animalistic.
Yep.
I guess that's where I'm confused. I can't understand. I mean, Jack the Ripper was doing it not for monetary gain. I don't understand what the hell his purpose was. I don't understand
practice.
Yeah, I mean, if Jack the Ripper truly was H.H. Holmes and became Dr. H.H. Holmes when he landed on American soil, then perhaps the Jack the Ripper slayings were all just practice. But what the hell put somebody into that? Because he didn't really need the financial gain from what he was doing. It was minuscule to sell the skeletons and so forth, even though he could articulate the skeletons so perfectly, which to me is also kind of fucking
well
creepy.
No, it was completely monetary back then. I mean, you have to understand that H.H. Holmes was H.H. Holmes before he was Jack the Ripper, so that was basically like being on holiday for him. is he was over there, had whatever shit normally he had to do, and did the killings in between. When he came back, there were still more killings, like the one in Toronto. The Ohio killings.
We never did talk about that, Dane. What the hell? You told me at the
beginning
of the show we would talk about it.
Yeah.
No, the Ohio killings were after that. I mean, there was a timeline to where he was Holmes. The murder castle was already erected, and then he went to Europe and then came back.
Right. Right.
Now, Dane,
so is that,
where at in Ohio was H.H. Holmes thought to have committed his crimes?
In Toronto, you mean?
Okay. Dane?
No, he was at your old house.
Everywhere that Holmes went. He was in Indianapolis, he committed murder. He was in Dallas.
Right.
He was down in Texas.
There was
in Ohio.
He was in San Francisco. He committed murders. He was in Toronto, and he committed murders. He was in New York, and he committed murders.
Are they basing this on M.O., or are they basing what basis are they attributing all these locales to?
There were victims found after he was hung based on witness testimony and the inspector had sent out a team to go check on all these leads, and they found out that indeed all the witness testimonies coming back, they'd find a body here, find a body there, and where the testimonies said that he killed, there were bodies. So, in fact, did they find victims of Holmes? Yes, but they were found way after the fact.
You know, it makes you wonder, had he stayed on the good and enlightening side of the medical field versus going to that side of it, what good would he have done to humanity in the long run? You know,
right, he would have. Right. However, there's one telling aspect to that. He would not have been able to vindicate what he felt humanity did against his father. And that was his whole purpose for his entire motivation in committing these crimes and killing people and committing fraud and becoming a shyster. His entire motivation was because he wanted to vindicate what happened to his father.
Well, on the flip side,
one more question, then I got to go.
All right.
Okay. One more, and then I got to go. Go ahead.
Wait.
I'll let you.
From you or to you?
No, to me.
Oh. Well, I have one statement, and then Dennis, if you have a question, because I talk to Dan a lot, but... the one thing that I have noticed is looking at home students of what they've done for the medical field. And I have a list, just not with me. But I don't know if you've looked into that aspect of it. That there are some big names of revolutionary medical advancements because of being his student.
Sure. The guy was... he was so perfect with the scalpel. And he was taught by the best to articulate.
Yeah,
articulate skeletons.
I have a list of people that have done actually and gotten notoriety for medical advancement that were
right.
His student. But,
right, but even
no,
early on,
that,
his entire purpose, his entire motivation for going to medical school was for one purpose, and one purpose alone.
To become a sick bastard?
You are exactly. I mean, you can't say it any clearer than that. He wanted to get back at humanity for what they did to his father. And that's made clear.
Dennis, did you have another question?
Pardon me?
I do have one more question that I'm curious to see, and I'm going to try to cross-correlate beginning of the century with today. Do you think if we had today's forensics or even forensics from 30 years ago available at the turn of the century when he was doing his crimes, do you think we could have caught him?
The entire case would have been different. The entire case would have
been able to slip the system.
No. Well, I think two things come into. Holmes was intelligent enough to be able to work with what he had, work with the best, work with the newest, and he would have found ways to attempt to surpass the system. Okay. However, if you take what evidence we have from the then, and you bring it in the present, many things would have been changed because you have fingerprints on letters supposedly written by the Ripper and blood on these letters, DNA testing and prints. That would have given us a lot. Speculation would have been gone out the window. We would have known for sure who they would have been sent by, who licked the stamps, where the blood came from.
If they're in the system.
Correct. And the victims would have been handled much differently because there would have been the entire investigation process would have been handled much differently. There would have been fingerprints, scannings done. They would look for blood splatters, even if they were 50 feet away. They would not have had today, they would not have to, on their eyes. That's all they had in their senses, their eyes and their nose could only go so far. But with the technology available today, it opens up a universe of possibilities.
Right.
Those
one
crimes
last question, then I'll leave
today,
you alone.
Those crimes today, the perpetrator would be caught within a week.
Okay, you just answered my next question. Because my next question was, my next question was going to be, do you think we'll ever have anybody as diabolical and as, I don't even know what the hell word to use, as
grotesque
H.H. Holmes?
No, I don't. I don't think anybody will ever be able to get to the level, to the point where they're going to be able to craft a murder castle. They can basically get their subjects from a World's Fair or a social event of that magnitude and be as crafty, clever, intelligent, and as evil as Holmes. Yeah, he was diabolical. He was Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
I think the last one that we'll see for a while till they get a shit ton smarter was Jeffrey Dahmer.
Well, he did effects.
Yeah, that was a sick son of a bitch there.
You know what, though? He was very, well, besides the homosexual rape, but, I mean, he was very, very close to Holmes as far as acid baths in his house, the amount of victims, the way he'd lure them in. Like, it wasn't that far off, and that was within all three of our generations.
Yeah, but he was just a ticking time bomb waiting to go off. He was very, very unintelligent in the way he did it. He was doing it in an apartment building, you know, and people were already, they had complained to the building manager about smells emitted from his apartment. Someone who is that intelligent should know that there's going to be smells emitted. If you can cut a human body up and you can stash parts in your fridge and your freezer and have someone's left elbow for dinner, okay, you should be smart enough to be able to get rid of the smell.
Yeah, you would think he would have some way to do that. Now, I will say this. 15 years ago, I guess, a buddy that I hung out with had a third-floor apartment. We hung out. He didn't smoke in the apartment, so we hung out on his balcony. In 6 months, we hadn't seen the guy on the second floor in that apartment. Had never seen him on his balcony. We're hanging out there one night, drinking, shooting the shit, having a cigarette, and we noticed this dude's walking in and out, in and out, in and out. And we're like, what in the... In 6 months, we hadn't seen this son of a bitch. The next night, we get a knock on the door. He was my drinking buddy. So I'm back over there the next night drinking with him, hanging out on the balcony. There's a knock on his door. It's a detective. They're looking for the young lady that lived in the apartment right below his. And just instantly, I just saw woods. Well, you've got 300 yards maybe of woods or field, and then it goes in the woods behind the apartments. The detective was asking, have you seen the young lady that lives downstairs? She normally calls her mother 2 to 3 times a day, hasn't called her in 2 days. And I blurted, look in the woods. Detective looked at me and said, excuse me? So look in the woods. I just know she's in the woods. The guy downstairs, we haven't seen him in 6 months. And all of a sudden, he's pacing in and out, and he's lighting a cigarette off of the cigarette on the deck. We haven't seen him on the deck in 6 months. Well, sure enough, he had somehow beat her in the head. Now, whether that's what killed her or not, we don't know. We haven't seen the autopsy. But we did find out that he beat her in the head,
cut her body in half in the bathtub and carried her off in two separate trash bags to separate ends of the woods. But somebody like him, you know, it was a crime of passion, it was a moment of rage, whatever in the hell it was that set him off. He gave himself away by pacing in and out, whereas H.H. Holmes was able to mingle amongst the population and nobody suspected anything.
Nobody.
Where that
nobody
in itself is just, to me, that is just amazing that nobody had a clue. Jeffrey Dahmer, nobody had a clue either, but he was leaving clues just like this guy down in the second floor apartment. Something's not right.
Here's the one question that I have never, Dane, you don't have to answer it tonight because I know you have to go and go to bed or do whatever. But the one question that's bugged me, and I want to plant the seed in your head, is if you think about what
he wants to plant seed in your head.
So if you think about what Holmes did and what his mentality was, how, like, his accomplices, do you think were approached to him or approached by him?
Well,
that's a really cool question.
Well, every one of his accomplices, if you do your research on them, they had rap sheets an arm length long. Okay? And I believe Holmes was so intelligent on how he could get people to do things he wanted, that he would set them up only to have something hanging over their head. And that's how he got them to do the things he wanted them to do.
Yeah. Well, just devil's advocate of it.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that maybe somebody locally was on him or had seen something that he was able to manipulate to show them the financial gain of it?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I know that for sure.
And that's why they started working with him instead of turning him in.
I know that to be an absolute positive truth, and that stands true for Benjamin Peitzel, who was in with him with insurance scams long before the insurance scam that cost Peitzel his life. And Peitzel and he were on a few deeds of loss of life prior to Peitzel's murder. Peitzel was in it. Dude, he was a snake. Peitzel was a snake. And he certainly handpicked the people that he allowed in his circle, based on what they went through and what was on their rap sheet. Definitely. Definitely.
Well, my question is, and like I said, I just thought of this talking tonight, but and I don't know if you have any insight to this at all, but I'm talking about like an innocent person, not a shitbag, not a snake, like maybe a neighbor that happened to see something and Holmes was able to manipulate them into saying, hey, if you keep your mouth shut or if you really want to make some money, this is where it's at, and brought them in on the scheme of somebody who was an honest person.
I think that he was a little more selective than that. Now, mind you, when he had ABC Copier Company, he was dealing with some business-type men, and he was above board. And businessmen did come to him and want to strike up some business deals with him and on a hotel. They wanted to buy into the hotel. Okay? Now, to my knowledge, I've not come across anything where it would indicate that Holmes was exposed and felt threatened by anyone that he was exposed from, other than Benjamin Peitzel, because he knew Peitzel could blow everything wide open, so he had to kill him. Other than that, I did not come across anything that would indicate that.
Yeah, I haven't looked into it either. I just, like I said, it was an idea that spitballed in my head when we were talking about it, of like, possibly could have he persuaded somebody into his schemes.
Well, understand that he had a lot of higher ups. And you know, in thinking about it now that you just clicked something, he had a lot of higher ups in his pocket. And he actually did persuade someone to enter into his scheme, which was his, at the time was his best friend and his schoolmate, Edmund Buckley. And he plays a very big role. He plays a very big role in Holmes and London. And in a very big way, Holmes did, if you will, suck him into the whole articulating of the bodies and disfiguring the bodies to scam insurance companies. Because Holmes saw that Buckley came from a wealthy London family, and he wanted a piece of the pie, and he did get it.
Well, and you know what? Come to think of it, wasn't when he was doing, like, when he first started out, wasn't he mixed matching skeletons to where they...
Was it what?
Like, at the forensic time that they couldn't put two and two together?
He was doing some of that. But most people weren't asking him at the time where he got the skeleton. He did very, very fine work on articulating. And with that, they were so happy about getting a finely articulated skeleton at a fraction of the cost it would have cost them in the open market. You know, he would sell at black market for $200, and on open market, it cost him $2,000. And in that day, that was a lot of money, $2,000.
Yeah.
But see, Holmes was smart. Holmes was smart. He knew from his surplus coming into the World's Murder Castle, World's Fair Hotel, he knew that he could make up that $2,000 just by articulating a few more bodies. He knew he had the surplus. So it was no big deal to sell it for $2,000.
But I was saying more or less, wasn't he doing or taking like a femur from, or two femurs from one and putting it into another skeleton?
That was at the very beginning when they were actually raving robbing graves because they had to do that while they were trying to get started with the scamming of the insurance companies and things of that nature. They actually did take not just femurs and things of that nature, bones. They actually took different parts from people's coffins so that they would be decayed and beyond recognition and so on, because somebody from the insurance company actually had to come and make an eyewitness to verify that there was a body. And by the time they made it, you know, the parts would be there and be all disfigured and stuff, and they'd all, you know, pull a sheet down, and the person from the insurance company would see it, put the sheet back up, and, yeah, there's a body there. It's in pieces or whatnot, or, you know, they'd put clothes on it, and you wouldn't even see that there were just many pieces, and that's how he was able to get away with scamming the insurance companies. The guy was sick and twisted, very much. You see these old movies where you see grave robbers, you know, the old black and whites and stuff, and that was him. But then he was also the diabolical mad doctor, and he took it to another level. So anyway, guys, I got to run, and it was awesome being on tonight. I appreciate it.
Yeah, no, we definitely enjoyed it. And some of the information that you've given tonight, as far as, you know, just the insight into the warped and twisted shit that...
Right.
Even if it turns out that Jack the Ripper and H.H. Holmes are two different individuals, I think they studied from the same casebook, and I think they studied from the same manuals.
Right.
It's just fascinating information. But thank you so much, Dane, and we'll definitely talk because I want to
cool.
see about getting you and you know, the others that were mentioned earlier on the other serial killers and so forth. I think that would make for a fantastic show. Pardon the pun, but that would make a killer conversation.
Yeah, right. Now, I want to ask you as a going away question here.
Uh-oh.
In your opinion, do you think there's enough information to consider Holmes as a viable suspect?
As a viable suspect for the 200 plus killings in Chicago,
as Jack the Ripper,
or as Jack the Ripper?
Yeah, a viable suspect.
Well,
in the case of Jack the Ripper?
Well, to my understanding, the timeline works out where he was in one location and then the other. The methods in which he performed his just gruesome crimes and what he did with the talent that he gained, if we take the assumption that as Jack the Ripper, while he was in London, if we take the assumption that that was practice, yes, there is enough viable information that the assumption can be made, and it's a good likelihood that Jack the Ripper and H.H. Holmes are one and the same.
Very good. I ask because the entire purpose of my writing the book is to show that throughout history we have missed one of the biggest viable suspects to be considered as Jack the Ripper, that being H.H. Holmes.
My only salt in the pot would be the married one. I'll stick to my guns and say I don't think that was him.
And that's good, because that will be in volume two.
So you, let me make sure I understand this. Matt, you don't think they're one in the same?
No, I don't think the fifth and, well, quote-unquote, final Jack the Ripper killing was done by Holmes. The fourth is more questionable than the fifth.
Fair enough.
I'll be asking you again,
Matt, after you read the book.
Yeah. But like I said, I'm not questioning it. It's just in the way that my mind works, the brutality of that killing, I have more questions than confidence. And that's personally just my opinion. You could be 100% right.
You're entitled. But would he be a suspect or a person that you would say is not a viable suspect?
Personally, I would lean more towards no, and it would be somebody else. If
I know. On all the Ripper murders.
Yeah, I would say number five would be no.
Okay, one through four.
One through three, 100%. Four.
Okay.
I'm 60-40 that he was, just due to the amount of time that he had on that murder. If somebody he heard footsteps walking up or something along those lines, that cut it short. But Mary, I'm honestly 80-20 leaning towards no.
Well, that's cool. You know, you're 100% correct, and I think I'm glad just to hear you say that one through three, that you would consider him as positively a viable suspect for the Jack the Ripper murders. And I'm good with that, dude.
Well, four and five, I would consider him as a suspect, but...
Mm-hmm.
If I had to make an accusation, I'd 80% yes, 20% no, 5, maybe 95-5.
Cool. That's cool.
So if I'm not mistaken, with the overall total, yeah, you think he's a suspect in all five of them, Matt. Good job. Way to get around that bush right through the middle and narrow it right now. Right. Fucking drinking teaspoon in Athens ass, why don't we?
We're going to be cut off in 3 minutes anyway, so.
Right.
Dane, till next time, my friend. Love you, brother.
Yes, and guys, thank you again. Thanks for taking me global.
Yeah. Hey, no problem, man.
By the way, Renee in New Zealand thinks it was a great show.
Cool.
Talk to you off air, I hope, so we can set up the next on-air schedule with maybe some other researchers regarding the serial killers.
Very cool. And, Matt, you and I will talk hopefully this week. There's a couple things I wanted to follow up on with you.
Yeah,
that we
no
talked
problem.
About already. Okay, cool. Very
yeah,
cool. Thanks, guys. I appreciate it. Yeah,
hey, Dan, real quick, did I show you my new number, right?
Yeah, I have it. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, just give me a call anytime.
Great. Great. Thanks.
And you still got my number, Dane, so take care, brother. We'll talk to you next time.
All right, guys. You have a good one. We'll talk to you later.
Thank you, sir.
Good night.
All right. Well, looking at the board, Matt, we are probably going to, as you said, get cut very shortly. So I'm going to go ahead and throw this out. I'll throw out our closing credits, and we will be on our way. What do you think?
Works for me.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, thanks for joining. I am CPR Dennis. That is CPR Matt. You can find us both on Facebook and Twitter. You can also find Chicagoland Paranormal Researchers at .com and Facebook. Make sure to join us next Wednesday night. We're not sure who we have, but I think we have a pretty phenomenal anatomical, medical, paranormal tie-in. I think we're going to find some information that you may really like. But, ladies and gentlemen, have a safe week, and we hope to catch you next week on Wednesday. Same place, same time, 9 p.m. Eastern, 8 Central. Thanks again.